This is tape number one, side number one of The Missing Dimension in Sex by Herbert W. Armstrong. In all the avalanche of books, magazine, and newspaper articles, the pamphlet on sex, the most vital dimension in knowledge, has been missing until this volume. Everywhere, from every direction, sex is hurled at the public in movies, on television, in newspapers and magazines, in advertising, TV commercials. A curiosity-hungry public has gulped down eagerly the bombardment. The so-called new morality has revolutionized Western civilization, with the most vital dimension of knowledge missing until this volume. Teens have come to talk freely about sex, like the boy of six whose father, much embarrassed, said, "Son, I think you and I should have a little talk about, sex." "Oh, sure, Dad," said the boy. "What do you want to know?" Millions of teens are already experienced in sex, yet are unknowledgeable on the subject. Even the, quote, experts, end quote, have knowledge in which the most vital dimension is missing. Herbert W. Armstrong has founded three liberal arts co-ed colleges in California, Texas, and England. He is pastor general of the Worldwide Church of God. For many years, he taught college classes on the subject. Even the best informed will find important knowledge new to them and important in this book. The Missing Dimension in Sex. The most important dimension in knowledge about sex and marriage had been missing, unpublished until this book, by Herbert W. Armstrong. Copyright 1964, 1971, 1981, by Worldwide Church of God, all rights reserved. Library of Congress Catalog Card Number 80-70719. First edition, October 1964, 250,000 copies. Second edition revised, April 1971, 400,000 copies. Third edition revised, May 1981, 384,000 copies. Table of Contents. Read this first. Introduction. Chapter 1. World in Revolt. Why this book had to be written. Chapter 2. Why and what is the missing dimension? Chapter 3. How shame entered. Chapter 4. Why sex? Its true meaning. Chapter 5. The divine purposes of sex. Chapter 6. But was sex really necessary? Chapter 7. Recapturing the true values of sex, the commanded functions. Chapter 8. The biological differences. Chapter 9. How God designed sex. Chapter 10. Fearfully and wonderfully made. Chapter 11. The God-ordained uses of sex. Chapter 12. Dating and teenage morality. Chapter 13. The best age for marriage. Chapter 14. Planned Parenthood, contraceptives, and sexual dysfunctions. Chapter 15. Engagement and the wedding night. And then index.
Read this first. If ever the Western world needed a book, it needs this one now. In no area of human life has there been such drastic social change as in that of sex. The so-called new morality, first unleashed by World War I, intensified by World War II, completely KO'd Western civilization during the decades of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Prior to the First World War, it was illegal in the United States to publish, sell, or distribute a book of instruction on the subject of sex. After World War I, an avalanche of books, pamphlets, magazines, and newspaper articles, teachings on sex, descended on the public. Yet in all this, the most vitally needed dimension of knowledge was missing. During the 50s, 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, sex has been hurled at the public in every manner. In movies, in television, in all advertising, in TV commercials. Everywhere, sex came to be freely talked about. Morals relaxed. The new morality became accepted by society. Divorces escalated. Family and home life became almost non-existent, yet a solid family structure is the very foundation of a stable and enduring society. There has floated abroad the delusion that whatever is new and different is more progressive and modern and therefore better. Far more often, it is retrogression. The purposes and true meaning of both sex and marriage are extremely vital to know. Physical details can be rightly understood only in the light of what has gone before in this volume. This astonishing knowledge, especially as presented in the earlier and middle chapters of this book, is as vital as it is surprising. It is important to read this book in its rightful order, beginning with chapter 1. Regardless of how much knowledge the reader may have acquired on the subject, he will find much that is new to him in this book, and he will come to see this entire subject in an entirely new light. The impetus which started research and gathering of material for this book in 1949 was the need to produce our own textbook for the Principles of Living course in Ambassador College. However, the accelerating demand from the constantly enlarging readership of The Plain Truth, now nearly 3 million subscribers in all parts of the world, necessitated preparation of a work for the instruction of this vast number of people in all walks of life and in all levels of education. Purposely, therefore, we have avoided the staid, dry, pedantic, professorial language of scholarship which seems typical of the average university-level textbook. Such writing may inflate the intellectual vanity of the author, but it is our purpose to convey knowledge to the reader. The purpose of words is to convey meaning. We have tried to make this text as plain and understandable as it is frank. We have endeavored to make it easy to read. This work has been produced out of genuine concern and deep compassion for a humanity robbed by false teachings as well as by ignorance of the joys, the delights, and the rich blessings which have been made possible. But these may be ours today if only we will open our minds to receive what has been missing until now. Read and reread it from beginning to end with a clean heart, a right spirit, and an understanding mind, and you will be richly rewarded. Introduction. Sex in the 80s. Where have 6 decades brought us? The world has emerged from the age of hush. A moral revolution has swept the world. Few under 30 have any conception of what the previous 4,000-year-long world was like. Few over 30 are aware of the extent to which the new morality has progressed in reverse. Little was known about sex. The subject was never discussed. It was unlawful in the United States to publish, sell, or distribute any knowledge about sex or teaching in its use. Certainly, young married people sorely needed proper information. After World War I, the legal dam was removed. The floodgates against published sex information opened. An avalanche of books, magazine, and newspaper articles flooded over the United States like a tidal wave. One can hardly pick up a magazine on a newsstand that does not feature at least one article on sex. The medical doctors, the gynecologists, the psychoanalysts, the sexologists ground out authoritative books conveying information and teaching on the subject of sex. Yet in all this dissemination, the most essential dimension of knowledge was missing. It has remained for this present volume to reveal that all-important dimension, its real meaning and purposes. This missing dimension in knowledge has not been revealed by religion, by the medical fraternity, by the authorities on the subject, nor by higher education. You will find it only in this book. Do not glance over and pass that portion of this book. It is a million times more valuable than the technical physical knowledge. The latter, without the former, can be ultimately disastrously fatal. For this is, in true fact, the most important and necessary book ever published on sex. Today we live in a different world. Sex is everywhere discussed and almost as promiscuously indulged. But the new freedom is by no means limited to the sexual response. The modern plunge has dived much deeper than even a modern society is aware. First, take a swift overview of progress after a year in the 80s. Then a surprised, to those of 30 and below, glance back into the pre-World War years as it had been for some 4,000 years. Our camera zooms now into the Western world before and after two divergent human societies. The contrast ought to arouse the reader to sober thought, but will it? Or have we become too lukewarm to be concerned? Our own future and eternity hangs in the balance. Today's condition and trend is so frightening in what it portends, it ought to shock every individual out of complacency into desperate action to reverse the ominous tide. But the facts of life as we speed through the 80s have not hit us suddenly in a 24-hour day or a single week. The deadly contrast is not so apparent because it came on us gradually over a period of 6 decades, 2 full generations. The new morality world was spawned after the turn of the century. It developed from the embryo stage during World War I. It surged, mostly among teens, unnoticed by their parents, on past World War II. The emergence of television after that war gave the trend great impetus. Acceleration sped the downward plunge. The new morality really surfaced during the 60s, blossomed into full bloom in the 70s. Where are we now, after a year in the 80s? In the United States, 1 million teenage girls, unmarried, get pregnant every year. Conditions in England, Sweden, and Western Europe rival this. Two Johns Hopkins University professors, Melvin Zelnick and John F. Kantner, in a very recent study report that 50% of the nation's teenage girls, age 14 to 19, have had premarital sex. The survey showed the percentage has significantly increased since 1971. Today, with the avalanche of sex literature and sex education published since World War I, and with sex everywhere freely discussed, the teens are indeed wise in sexual discussion and sexual experience, but still woefully ignorant in sex knowledge. Syracuse University professor Saul Gordon says fewer than 10% of all teenagers have been given any school sex education. And of course, they receive little or none from their parents. The gutter knowledge acquired from their peers is woefully inadequate. Yet, they are wise in their own conceits, like the boy whose father, in agitated embarrassment, said, "Johnny, I think it's time we had a talk about sex." "Fine, Dad," came the answer. "What did you like to know?" Sex ignorance is testified by the fact of 250,000 reported adolescent gonorrhea cases annually. Not long ago, a third of marriages in the United States resulted in divorce. Today, the divorce rate has swelled to one half of all marriages. The foundational bulwark of any healthy, stable, and permanent society is the family unit. Before World War I, it was a rare married woman who worked away from home. I remember during World War I my own surprise at seeing women employed for the first time as elevator operators in the Marshall Field store in Chicago. Such jobs never had been for women. Today, only 13% of U.S. families include a working father, homemaking mother, and one or more children. What would an Abraham Lincoln think of that? Or even a Theodore Roosevelt? Or a Woodrow Wilson? Would they not turn over in their graves if they knew? Over 2.5 million American men and women avoid marriage altogether, yet live together, either as unmarried heterosexuals or as homosexuals. By 1990, a virgin standing at the marriage altar will be a phenomenon. Many ask today, why marriage at all, anyway? Some experts say marriage will soon be a thing of the past. There is today a definite conspiracy, active on television, in newspapers, and in universities, to do away with the institution of marriage. Though most people in the 80s will marry at least once, there will be a broad variety of options. This will include living alone by choice, though by no means will it preclude sex. It will include single parentage by women, unmarried twosomes, both homosexual and heterosexual. It will include communal living and unrelated families. The number of unmarried couples living together doubled in the 70s. Today, authorities say change in partnership may be seen as predictable, understandable, even desirable. We'll back away from the notion of lifelong marriage. Loosening attitudes toward sex, shout the expert conspirators, will help propel these changes. With legalized abortion and improved contraception, coming on the 80s horizon are an anti-pregnancy vaccine, birth control implants under the skin, and a birth control pill for men. Sex will be equated with fun, pleasure, enjoyment, not babies. Since it is a basic truism that a solid family structure is the foundational bulwark of any stable and permanent society, this fact means only one thing. Civilization as we know it is on the way down and out, unless that great unseen strong hand from someplace soon intervenes and saves today's sick society. But before we leave the world scene of the 80s, bear in mind the present world in revolt is in rebellion against much more than pre-20th century sex repression, and the modern downward spiral of humanity involves a much wider area than sex alone. Today, the family structure of Western life is endangered by much more than illicit and promiscuous sex. Along with the modern sex rampage of adolescence has come other addictions that titillate, arouse, stimulate, and please the physical senses. Accompanying sexual indulgence has come, in teen life, alcohol, drugs, tobacco, modern X-rated movies, gangsterism, violence. They look for every pleasing, stimulating sensation. Some appeal to the sense of feel, some to sight, some to hearing, like rock and disco music with the sensual beat and the rhythm. Some to the sense of smell. People smell tobacco smoke. Cigarette ads speak only of taste, but you cannot taste smoke. Believe it or not, you cannot taste smoke. But as the smell of tobacco smoke becomes addictive in the nostril and affects body and mind in the lungs, so pot or marijuana, opium, and other smoke affects the mind and stimulates. One gets high, experiences new sensations. Heroin and other hard drugs even more so. Nearly all who become hooked on the hard drugs started on marijuana. The movies bring pleasures through the sense of sight and of sound. Kids spend hours a day before the one-eyed monster. It provides a ready-made daydream, and misuse not only dulls the mind, television has been a prime medium by which the anti-family conspiracy has injected its deadly poison into juvenile and adult minds. Make no mistake, television is an industry devoted to entertainment, pure and simple. Of course, one finds occasionally on TV a truly educational and or worthwhile program or documentation. But TV is a business for profit in America. It provides entertainment so that people have commercials selling goods and services thrust before them. The entertainers, even news announcers who are themselves primarily entertainers, say before a commercial break, "Stay tuned or we'll be right back. Don't go away." The viewer is literally forced to allow the commercial huckster to inject his sales pitch into the mind. Another modern evil, seldom recognized as such, is the working wife and mother. Family life has undergone a radical revolution. Teens have sex games at home in bed while dad and mom are at work. Children do not eat with parents. They seldom go to movies with parents. Parents have their lives, associates, and friends apart from the children. Parents never think of teaching children, being with children, maintaining a family relationship. Parental responsibility is totally neglected. In due time, parents are going to be brought to account for this neglect of basic responsibility. But now, what a surprise for the under 30s. The young people of today have little awareness of the sex and family conditions in pre-war years. In fact, until 1914, there had been little basic change for some 4,000 years. The prior to 1914 years were as different from today's world as day is from night. Parents then, even as now, taught their children nothing about sex. They themselves knew nothing. Their parents never had taught them. Besides, it would have been too embarrassing. The commonly accepted dictum was, "Keep our children innocent through ignorance until marriage, then instinct will teach them." But instinct did not teach them. Humans, unlike animals, do not come equipped with instinct. Blindly, with a smattering of gutter-acquired misknowledge, the newly married blundered their way into disillusionments, shattered dreams, bitter resentments, and frustrations, and too often the divorce courts, although divorces were still a rarity. True, a very large percentage of girls were kept pure. The girl, up until 1914, who lost her virginity unmarried, had also lost her honor. Of course, a double standard had developed. Every man wanted a virgin for a wife, but a majority were less careful about male virtue. Yet the girl who had gone the limit was damaged goods. Those under 30 today know little about prevailing attitudes and sexual behavior prior to the two world wars. Contrarywise, if a girl who died at age 22 prior to 1917 were resurrected suddenly back to life today, she would be appalled, horrified at the prevailing attitude and behavior of 22-year-old girls today. Just what are the generally unrealized facts? What was the real origin of the then traditional Christian morality? And conversely, what triggered the moral revolution, the so-called new morality? How did today's moderns come to accept present attitudes and behavior patterns? What has finally, after thousands of years of the sex's shameful repression, plunged the world into prevalent sexual freedoms? And what, after all, is the plain truth? What, after all, are the true values? Was the pre-World War concept better for humanity? Is the present new morality really advancement, really better for those who are swept along with it? People who lived prior to the 20th century would be aghast if they could see life as it is lived today. Up until World War I, people believed in marriage and family life. My own family was typical. I had never known of a divorce or a broken home and family in any of my relatives or ancestors. Marriage was, until death do us part. Any other status or lifestyle would have been strange and shocking. But what brought about this drastic change? Chapter 1, World in Revolt, Why This Book Had to Be Written. Why world acceptance of the new morality? What, until 1914, had been the Western world's standard of morality? Was it good or bad? Has a whole world in revolt brought anything better? What have been the facts? What have been the causes? It is not only a moral revolution, a revolution in government, in economics, in science and technology, in education, in labor standards, and in social values, even in religion, has shaken the whole world. Why? Why has the whole world suddenly aroused to violent action, and especially in the area of morals? We will give specific causes a little later. The authorities, the psychoanalysts, and the medical doctors decided moral standards were in need of revision, and they have been revised radically under the catchphrase, the new morality. Yet few realize the facts of the true origin of the sex's shameful attitude, or of the impetus behind the moral revolution. The facts are stranger than fiction. The most vital dimension, missing. The world, since the First World War, as mentioned above, has been deluged with books, pamphlets, and articles in magazines and newspapers about sex. Still, the most necessary dimension in knowledge of the subject has been missing, unpublished until this book. Today, protest fills the air. Revolt is everywhere, against almost everything. And in no grievance is revolt so widespread as that against the repressive moral codes of traditional Christianity. The revolters reject the authority of the church. They have embraced what they term the new morality. Just what are the generally unknown facts? What was the real origin of the traditional Christian morality? Did it come from Christ, from the original apostles, from the Bible? And what triggered the moral revolution and finally plunged the world into the sexual freedoms of today? Origin of the old morality. Christianity, following its first generation, absorbed the pagan dualism of Greece and pasted the label sinful on sex. Through the centuries since, the moral standards of the Western world were regulated by the Roman Catholic Church. Does that mean, then, that Christ introduced and taught this attitude that sex of itself is shameful and evil? Emphatically, it does not. Jesus never represented sex as anything other than that which our Maker created, and all that He had created, God pronounced very good. Jesus taught against wrong uses of sex. He forgave a repentant woman caught in the act of adultery with the admonition, "Go and sin no more." The original apostles never deviated from this teaching. The biblical teaching throughout is the same. What then was the real source of this attitude of shame? It flowed on the tide of the Babylonian mystery religion into the Roman world. And how did this concept come to be accepted as Christian? The facts, I repeat, are stranger than fiction. Emphatically, it was not the teaching of Hebraism, nor of Jesus, nor of the original Church of God. It reached the Roman world by way of Greece, but it flowed at an earlier date into Greece from Egypt. Yet it stems from a still earlier source to be revealed in the following chapter. In the first and second centuries, the Roman world was dotted by pagan schools on the curricular model established by the Grecian Plato. Plato had received this dualistic attitude towards sex from his teacher, the philosopher Socrates, himself a sex pervert. This dualistic teaching had become the basic hypothesis of all Grecian thought, writing, and religion. Sex was regarded as low and degrading, an act in which man descended to the level of the beast. This was the underlying attitude in the teaching of the pagan schools throughout the Roman Empire. There were no Christian schools. To establish such schools would have been impossible. Textbooks had to be written laboriously by hand, one at a time. The printing press was not to be invented for centuries. All textbooks were pagan. Second and third generation Christians were reared and educated from childhood in these pagan schools. By the beginning of the 6th century, this dualistic concept towards sex was firmly rooted in Western Christianity. It is still the teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. Protestants in general have passively followed Catholic teaching on sex, but have tended to be more lax in behavior. The fruits of prudery. But what were the real fruits of that dualistic concept of virtue? Some 90% of marriages were rendered unhappy, many utterly miserable and unbearable because of false attitudes and sex ignorance. Many a wife was virtually raped on her wedding night. The stupid husband didn't mean to injure his wife. He was just plain ignorant. He needed instruction that had been denied him. Many wives called their husbands brutes. They simply were ignorant of the fact that brutes, guided by instinct, are not guilty of such things. Husbands said their wives were frigid and too often began to visit prostitutes. What price ignorance? Then came World War I. It brought tremendous changes in thinking, in behavior patterns, in social customs, and in the double standard. Women won the vote in America. Wives began entering employment and becoming financially independent. The Freudian conclusion. Previously, about 1904, a startling conclusion had been reached by Sigmund Freud, founder of psychoanalysis. This revolutionary opinion had resulted from his clinical experience and researches. Freud had decided that sexual repression, the attitude of shame, and ignorances about sex were the causes of neuroses and many mental disorders. He and his followers in the newly appearing profession of psychiatry urged knowledge dissemination and sexual freedom as the panacea. If repression and self-denial caused the neurotic disquiet, why not reverse the interpretation of morality? Emancipate the people from restraints. Put a new definition on sex. Define it as good, not degrading, shameful, and evil. Any use of sex in or out of marriage. In the wake of World War I, the agitation resulting from Freud's revolutionary conclusions finally brought about the toppling of the legal barriers, and the moral barriers began breaking down simultaneously. With the removal of legal restraints against sex instruction, medical doctors and psychoanalysts began grinding out volume after volume importing heretofore banned instruction about sex. Previously, the publication of knowledge in other fields had been accelerating, but in the delicate area of knowledge about sex, the medical and associated professions had held a monopoly. Now, sex information was hurled at the public from all directions. Even today, almost every magazine one might pick up off a newsstand will contain at least one article on the subject of sex, as noted earlier. Even the most conservative magazines. Besides, there are magazines devoted wholly to sex, and I do not mean pornographic magazines. The new morality appears. Yet something has been criminally wrong with this avalanche of sex literature. There has been missing the most vital dimension. The world began throwing off the restraints. The revolt was on against prudery, repression, and ignorance. The new sensual knowledge, with its most needed dimension missing, quickly began to be gulped in by curiosity-hungry minds. World War II shot morals into the gutter, and now they have plunged all the way into the cesspool. Permissiveness is the current fad. Today, it is actually becoming popular in more and more colleges and universities to allow students to visit the dorm rooms of those of opposite sex at any or all hours around the clock and sleep with them if desired. Many have introduced the system of co-ed dorms, both men's rooms and girls in opposite wings on the same floor, no restrictions whatsoever. Today, pornography is rampant on many school and college grounds, and smut has become a multi-million dollar industry in country after country. Today, we have progressed completely past topless bars and restaurants. When they became no longer shocking, bottomless followed, and finally, the supreme jolt as a shocker, and in several places, to entertain a lust-gripped audience, actual live sexual intercourse performed in the nude on stage. Not simulated, for real. Along with this trend had come the hippies, rock festival orgies attended by thousands, fast-growing drug addiction, hundreds of thousands literally blowing their minds. I mentioned above that the revolters have rejected the authority of the church, but where is the authority for a right moral code? Do humans really know right from wrong? After all, what is right and what is wrong? What is really best for each individual? It is generally assumed that every sane person knows the difference between right and wrong, but do they? Many Roman Catholics still think any use of sex outside of marriage is sin and therefore wrong. Perhaps a few non-Catholics still believe the same thing. On the other hand, millions now believe in the new morality. They believe in complete sexual freedom. They believe denial and repression is wrong. And even a very large segment of Catholics are relaxing their attitudes. There are other views in between. What is the truth? The truth is that the most tragically needed dimension in sex knowledge has been missing. Now, even marriage being questioned. In the modern rebellion against just about everything, including puritanical taboos, the world is tending to reject any and all authority and is turning more and more to impulse and unbridled desire. Now, some psychiatrists are questioning the institution of marriage. Who started the marriage custom anyway, and when? If man is merely the highest evolvement of the animal kingdom, when, in the evolutionary development from lower animal into man, did marriage with home and family start, and why? Animals do not marry. They have no home life. Yet all animals reproduce. Marriage is not necessary for reproduction. Do we really need any authority for what is right or wrong about sex, about marriage? Is sexual freedom by mutual consent really harmful to anybody? Is the game becoming prevalent of husband and wife swapping wrong? Is it harming the participants, or is it beneficial? Let's see what modern science and the scientific method has contributed. Vital new knowledge awaits the reader. Chapter 2, Why and What is the Missing Dimension? What an age, this age of the knowledge explosion. Few realize how recently it has developed. Its rapid acceleration has come only in this present century. The dissemination of knowledge about sex has occurred only since World War I. Medieval ignorance, coupled with the sex is shameful attitude and church repression, caused frustration and miserably unhappy marriages. But the modern diffusion of biological sex knowledge and the permissive sexual freedoms of the new morality have plunged the Western world from the frying pan into the fire. And why? Because the most vital dimension in knowledge about sex and marriage has been missing. Missing from all knowledge. But this vital dimension is missing not only from knowledge about sex and marriage, it is missing from knowledge in general. To understand, we need to realize the impetus behind the general knowledge explosion and how the most vital dimension came to be missing. The dramatic rise in the world's total fund of knowledge began roughly 170 years ago with the advent of modern science. The new knowledge in the fields of science and technology developed slowly at first. Knowledge production gained momentum gradually, and then finally came the knowledge explosion. Even when I was a boy, we used kerosene lamps, horse and buggy transportation, and the little dinky trolley cars which had just replaced the horse-drawn streetcars. Radio, television, airplanes were unheard of. It's hard to realize now that this world went along on virtually an even keel with no material progress to speak of for thousands of years. It was primarily an agricultural world, using primitive farming methods. The cast iron plow was not invented until 1797. The disc plow not until 1896 when I was a growing boy. The first harvester came in 1836. Think of it. Through those long millennia, the world was virtually without transportation or means of communication. Transportation was by foot, muleback, camel, elephant, or horse-drawn. By sea, it was slow-moving sailboat. The first steamboat, Fulton, was 1803. The telephone was not invented until 1876, wireless in 1896. In my lifetime, we have whipped past the machine age, the automobile age, the jet age, the nuclear age, and the space age. What stimulated this accelerating materialistic development? It occurred simultaneously with the sudden spurt to national wealth and power of two nations, Britain and the United States, beginning in 1800. With this suddenly acquired material wealth, our people became materialistically minded. The new Messiah, modern science. Modern scientists assured the world that man had progressed to the point where he could safely dispense with the superstitious crutch of religion and belief in God. Now humanity could rely on the new Messiah, modern science. Given sufficient knowledge, said the scientists, and we shall solve all of humanity's problems and cure all the world's ills. The tools of modern science were merely a stepped-up use of those man had employed since the dawn of history, observation, experimentation, and human reason. So knowledge production has increased at a fast accelerating pace, and this includes the area of sex. But evils increased also. Paradoxically, humanity's problems, troubles, and evils have been increasing at an equal acceleration. In the decade from 1960 to 1970, man's total fund of knowledge doubled. But incredibly, in that same 10 short years, the world's troubles and evils doubled also. The decade of the 70s produced a like advancement. What's wrong with the dictum that knowledge is the sole need for solutions? Increasing evils have come with increasing knowledge. That's the hard, cold fact that must be faced. Is it wrong to possess or gain knowledge? Most certainly not. Am I discouraging the acquisition of knowledge? By no means. On the other hand, we are face to face with the fact that evils have escalated along with the production of knowledge. That does not necessarily mean that the knowledge produced caused the evils. It does mean that the knowledge produced did not cure existing evils or prevent new evils. There has to be a knowledge gap, a missing dimension somewhere. It's high time we learn what it is. For every effect, there has to be a cause. There has to be a cause for all the world's evils. There has to be a cause for the worsening moral problem. There can be two kinds of knowledge, true and false. Academic freedom. In this feverish development of knowledge production, scholars in universities have been placing emphasis on academic freedom. Academic freedom is defined as the independent judgment allowed teachers, scholars, scientists, students in the pursuit of knowledge. Science as a whole and higher education have exercised the academic freedom to postulate a creation without a creator. They have engaged in the activity of knowledge production with total rejection of any possibility of the miraculous, the supernatural, the existence of God, or anything outside the realm of the material. In the realm of knowledge of the spiritual, they know nothing. They have rejected utterly revelation as a source of basic knowledge. When I engaged in research on the theory of evolution, I studied Darwin, Haeckel, Huxley, Vogt, Moore, Chamberlain, and other exponents of the theory. I also looked at the other side of the question, but I would venture to say that most of those whose higher education has been acquired during the past half century have been taught and have accepted without question the evolutionary theory, not having examined with any seriousness the biblical evidences of special creation. To go along with the evolutionary concept has become the scholarly in thing. In most institutions of higher learning, the world's bestseller has been dismissed without a hearing. Is it not human to err? Could it be possible for the most highly educated minds to have been intellectually misled or deceived? Could they, viewing only one side of the question, be infallible, entirely above making mistakes? The cause of errors. For many years now, I have observed that errors almost always come from a false basic premise, carelessly assumed as self-evident, and taken for granted without question, then building on that false basic hypothesis. The basic premise for knowledge production in our time has been the evolutionary concept. It has been the eyeglasses through which all questions have been viewed. Yet it remains unproved, and by its very nature it is a theory not subject to proof. It is a faith. And to question it is, to those who embrace this faith, academic heresy. Do we then dare question the theory so generally accepted by advanced scholarship? Is it heretical to question their assumed conclusions and ask for proof? Is it academic heresy to look at the other side of the coin? Suppose now we appropriate the academic freedom to carefully examine that which has been dismissed without examination. It might prove exciting and enlightening at this point to allow ourselves the latitude of academic freedom unprejudicially to examine the biblical narrative of the forbidden fruit. That bit of revelation purports to describe the crucial initial event in human experience that changed the entire course of history. The first three chapters of the Bible do have something to say about sex and marriage. And, after all, the man and the woman there described were naked, were they not? Evidently few, if any, whether scientist, scholar, or theologian, have viewed this account with any remote conception that it might explain the origin of the scientific method of knowledge production, or that it might reveal the very source of the fatal missing dimension. Certainly almost no one, theologians included, has ever understood what this account really does say. Begin at the beginning. I think we must begin our view of the forbidden fruit narrative at the beginning, the very first verse in the Bible. So we begin, in the beginning, God. That statement definitely puts God in existence before all else. No postulate, no guess, no perhaps. Just the simple positive statement, created the heaven and the earth. Whether fact or fiction, truth or error, that is what is written, purporting to be the revealed word of God. Something tremendous is indicated to have occurred between what is stated to have been the original creation of the earth, verse 1, and the statement in verse 2, and the earth was, or became, without form and void. Hebrew, tohu and bohu, meaning ruin, confusion, emptiness. See any Hebrew English lexicon. What occurred between events and conditions described in those two verses is revealed in many other biblical passages, and this allows for any duration of time between the two verses. So far as biblical statements are concerned, the original creation could have occurred millions of years prior to the state described in the second verse. Coming to the 26th verse, chapter 1, it is stated, "And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness." Other biblical passages state that man is in the same form and shape as God, but with this difference, that God is composed of spirit and man of physical matter. Now, verse 27, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them." Soul, spirit, or material. Here is a dogmatic statement that God designed and created sex. And next, chapter 2, verse 7, "And the eternal God formed man of the dust of the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." The flat statement is here recorded that what was made from material substance, dust of the ground, became a soul, a plain emphatic statement that the soul was made from matter, not spirit. Next comes the statement that God planted a garden or park in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. Note well these facts. The plain statement is that the man and woman were created as the final act of creation on the sixth day of the week described in the first chapter of Genesis. They had been created, even as we have been born, with human minds as yet unfilled with knowledge. But they were created as adults, with adult capacity minds capable of receiving and reasoning from knowledge. So their Creator began immediately to instruct them in necessary basic knowledge, and this, it is made plain, included instruction in sex and marriage. Naked and unashamed. God had said, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth." Chapter 1, verse 28. Again, "And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed." Chapter 2, verse 25. Mark, please, the plain statement that the attitude of shame was not imparted by God. At the conclusion of God's initial instruction, which included instruction about sex and reproduction, there was no sense of indecency or shame about that which God had designed and created.
This completes tape number 1, side number 1 of The Missing Dimension in Sex. Please continue on side 2.